Welcome to the Versus History Podcast with your hosts, Patrick O'Shaughnessy, Connell Smith, and Elliot Watson.
Hello, welcome to Versus History. Connell Smith here, along with Elliot Watson and Patrick O'Shaughnessy, the three of us, back around the mic today to talk to us and to talk to each other about something that is upcoming, but with a historical slant. How are you today, gents?
Tired. It's very early in the morning, Connell. Very early.
It's not early for me. I've got kids.
No, I was woken at 4:45 this morning by them, so I've been primed and ready.
I was like 4:25 or something.
So. Can I just clarify that I also have children?
Yeah, they're old.
But I've already gone through that transition.
They don't count. They're old.
I have the purple heart already, thank you, gentlemen.
I can't wait to look back on those days,
So what are we talking about, Pat, today?
We are talking about midterm elections. We're talking about the United States of America. By proxy, we're talking about the current president, Joe Biden, and what happens if he loses, or the Democratic Party lose the midterms in America that are forthcoming. What next?
Yeah, so the midterm election's coming up in November 2022. So for listeners who aren't aware, there are elections every 2 years in America to this particular body of Congress, the House of Representatives. And in those elections, every single seat, all 435 that exist in the House of Representatives, are up for grabs in the elections. And so this can lead to changes of majorities between the two major parties, the Republicans and the Democrats. But by virtue of the American system, every 4 years, so what's coming up, you've got, it's going to be complicated, isn't it? Breaking it down.
Every 2 years you're electing something, either the Congress or the President, right?
Should we start with, for those listeners who may not quite understand Congress, what Congress is, etc., should we just preface it there, go back first?
Why not? First principles.
Yeah. So, excuse me. Tuesday, November 8th, there are a bunch of elections in the United States. These are known as midterm elections because essentially they're in the mid-term of the presidency. And they are elections to elect the members of Congress. Now, Congress obviously is the legislature. It's the principal legislative body in the United States. And within Congress, we have what is known as the upper chamber, which is the Senate. And the lower chamber, which is the House of Representatives. There are 100 senators in, obviously, the Senate. There are two for each state of the Union. And since there are 50 states, there are 100 senators. In the House of Representatives, there are 435. And each state receives, by and large, a number of representatives, depending upon the size of their population. Now, a century ago, there was one member for about every 200,000 people. And today, there's one for about every 700,000. People. There's a lot of conflict and conversation about whether the number of representatives should rise as the population has risen, but I don't think it's changed since 1920. I might be wrong about that. Anyway, every 4 years, a third of the Senate seats are up for election, and all of the representative seats are up for re-election every 4 years. So in 2022, in November, all four, as a quirk of maths, all 435 House seats and 34 of the 100 Senate seats are on the ballot. Additionally, 36 out of 50 states will elect governors. Now, the problem obviously is whichever party has the majority in each chamber gets to, by and large, set the agenda, dominate that chamber, and legislate for the country. In order to control the House, a party needs at least 218 seats to win control of it. Now, right now, the Democrats have what in the Senate?
Majority.
They have a majority in the Senate. Nancy Pelosi is the House, is the Speaker. Is that right?
Yes, she is. Yes, she is. And they've got 220 of the representatives.
That's in the House. Yes. So right now the Democrats have a majority in the Senate. So essentially they control that.
Very narrow majority.
Very narrow. And in the House,
a slightly greater majority. I think they have 220 versus 205, 208. I think 208.
And so the problem comes, obviously, because the president, obviously, is a Democrat, and if they lose the two chambers of Congress, you end up with problems. And these are the problems we're going to, not the problems, these are the issues we're going to try and discuss today, where there is a historical precedent for this, where the president loses the House, and what this might mean.
Yeah, and I think it's perhaps important just to add as well, the process for laws in the United States is that Congress makes the law, but it has to be ratified or signed by the president in order for it to then become law. So they
it has to be signed into being.
Exactly.
Right.
And so once the House and the Senate can agree on a law, it goes to the president. And obviously, if they're all of the same party, they tend to be much more of accord. And therefore, the process, once you have a split, perhaps, between the houses of Congress from one party and the president from another, it's far less likely that that legislation is going to proceed nicely through and be signed into law.
Now, so what's the historical precedent here? Is the president, who the current president, Joe Biden, is the president likely to lose any seats in the House of Representatives in November?
Absolutely, yes. He absolutely
that's
is.
The answer.
And that's not a Joe Biden intentionalist-centric, individual-centric perspective. He probably is going to lose them, but historically, presidents or the party to which the president adheres usually loses seats, quite a significant number, at the midterm elections, perhaps in the same way the prime minister and the party to which he is affiliated in Great Britain loses by-elections and or local elections and or European elections. So the precedent is in America and elsewhere, yes.
A few stats here to reinforce that historical loss in the midterms usually that transpires. According to Inside Elections with Nathan L. Gonzalez, the president's party has lost an average of 30 House seats in midterm elections over the last 100 years. For the six times in 22 years, control of at least one chamber has switched to the opposing party in that first presidential term. And this time it's the Republicans who have the upper hand. So.
Well, it sounds like it's pretty conclusive.
Yeah, as far as the future can be,
yeah.
It looks like the incumbent president is going to lose control of the
Absolutely.
House.
Absolutely. I mean, AJP Taylor was the historian that said nothing's inevitable until it happens.
Mm-hmm.
But it's looking very likely that this will happen.
Yeah. It's interesting, though, also to think about the language that we use when we're discussing such a phenomenon. We're talking here about the president losing the House, but if we think about the mechanics of it, obviously the president isn't in the House, and there's a big distinction there to say the House of Commons in the UK, where the president is in the House of the Prime Minister is in the House of Commons. But in the US, the president is separate. We always see when people are running for the presidency, they'll often give up their Senate seat or their seat in the House of Representatives if they're from Congress in order to become president, maintain that separation
Absolutely.
Of powers, which was outlined by the Founding Fathers. So it's funny, the concept we talk about, the president losing the House, and I think partly perhaps that's a projection of the president being perceived as the leader of the party that they are affiliated
in
to.
In their role as the head of state, right? Perhaps with a tinge of presentism, because the president is the head of state and we see him, and it has been exclusively him up till now, on television and the media so much, we can be drawn into or sucked into the vortex of forgetting how the Founding Fathers conceptualized the government of America. The legislative Congress is Article 1, and that may well be because they envisaged it as being most important. And as you gentlemen have rightly outlined, it's they who table the laws. So maybe a tad different from Britain. The executive, the president, is Article 2, and it's his job, and it has been exclusively here up till now. It's his job to enact them. And that was really born out of the context of a tonic to law by man, arbitrary rule of a king, King George III. Now, the extent to which he's arbitrary is not for this debate, but he was the last monarch to exercise executive power, and when the Founding Fathers were compiling and debating the rubric of their government, it was born out of a British context, British colonial context, and born out of a king who could still essentially choose his prime ministers, bully his prime ministers, and issue orders in council. So if we go right up to the present, perhaps with a tinge of presentism, we remember the Congress during President Trump's tenure they reminded him that he didn't have the power to declare war. So Congress have not been backwards in coming forwards in reminding the president of their power. Now, in terms of the question, we do know it's a partisan government at the moment in America, and perhaps in Britain too. There is area for accord. We have bipartisan agreement on common land between the parties, so it's not out of the question, and it's not out of the scope of America's historical trajectory. But if Biden does lose the House, which is looking likely he will, I think that will be very difficult for him to chaperone, shepherd anything through. But that would be the same of any president too. Barack Obama had a real rough ride too.
Yeah, I think that has been a pattern, hasn't it? That if you look at political discourse and the discourse of political scientists over the last few decades, there's been increasing talk about the increasingly partisan nature of Congress. I'm thinking people like Thomas Mann, Norman Ornstein, talking about how even by 2009, they said that the House and the Senate was kind of unrecognisable to what they remembered from the 90s. And if we look back over the decade or so that we've had since then, yeah, partisanship has not diminished. If anything, it's trajectory has increased. So I think that is a very important point. And perhaps that means that losing the House is perhaps becoming more and more an actual loss. Absolutely. In terms of a binary flipping round or curtailing of a president's potential agenda than it would have been going back 50 years or 100 years or 200 years when perhaps cross-floor cooperation was more common.
But what's probably changed there is the personalities and the parties rather than the underlying principles and paradigm of the Constitution. Mm. The Constitution has changed very, very little in the
27 times.
The Founding Fathers made that deliberately so, and they've pretty much got their way with that. If they could see into the future, they would be pretty happy, I guess, with the miniature 27 changes. It's not the Constitution that's changed or the apparatus of Congress or the President. It's really their inability, or perhaps ability, depending which way you want to frame it, to work together. But that's essentially, you get what you're given in the sense of the American Constitution, because ultimately Congress has changed little, the President's changed little, just their ability to work together.
Okay, so why, if we get to the question, or the topic, what happens tradition? What is the outcome if, and when rather, the yes. President loses the House? So what? That's the question. So what?
It's a good question. We're probably going to look at it, I guess, from a what can't the president do? But let's look at it, what the Congress can still do. It can still table laws. Nothing's going to change in terms of the Constitution. Congress will still continue to function to do what it does, which is table laws.
Run its committees. Financial oversight, yeah.
So the functionality, logistics, administration of government won't change a ditty. So that will stay in place. What will be difficult if we flip it? It will be difficult for the president to get the stuff that he or she wants done and to chaperone things through the Congress, because simply they're not in control of it.
And what it means, therefore, is the presidential agenda
absolutely
is essentially dead in the water, because they can't, the president or the president's party will not be able to get any significant bills through, because they won't have that
absolutely
majority power or authority within the chamber. So you're going to have most of his bills dead in the water right from the beginning. Now, bills like appropriation, where there's usually some kind of cross-party accord, those things will go through as normal. But does that mean the president is essentially a lame duck?
Go on, Mr. Smith, you go for it.
I was going to say, it's an interesting question, because a lame duck is a term that's often used once a president has kind of lost their power, or perhaps has lost an election, is kind of going through the 4 months or whatever it is until a new president takes over. I guess it comes back to what you were saying, Patrick, doesn't it? Have they you can't lose something you've never had. The president, even when his party is in Congress, he does not have the power to write the laws. And so the president, by virtue of the position, is always reliant on cooperation with Congress. And I think looking at the ways in which laws change, laws will still get passed by Congress and they will still get signed into law by the president, but the nature of those laws is different. I think that if you look at the ambitions, I guess, of a president or a Congress, become less ambitious because they're far less likely to be realised. And so perhaps change which one is going to see in America will come more incrementally and more slowly when the president and the Congress are at odds than when they are in accord. You're unlikely to get sweeping reform. If you think about kind of the huge sweeping changes, things like the introduction of Obamacare, which kind of revolutionised the way in which something as significant as healthcare operates, that happened because the House, the Senate, and the president were of the same party. They were of a similar mindset, and so such broad legislation could be passed. Whereas the chance of similar legislation, regardless of its political bent or whatever, that cannot get passed, or is so unlikely to get passed. I think it changes the way in which America is governed in terms of changes are smaller, more incremental, and you are unlikely to get the paradigm shifts.
But I think it's worth remembering that there will likely be a shift in legislation enacted ideologically towards a more conservative viewpoint, as happened in 1994 in the middle of Clinton's midterm elections. The House of Congress was lost in inverted commas to the Republicans.
For the first time in decades.
Maybe?
Yeah, maybe. I think there'd been Democratic domination.
And it moved because Newt Gingrich at the time had publicised his contract with America, and people got behind that, and that was very much a more conservative ideological bent, and so Congress became more conservative. So I think we're likely to see that. We're likely to see a Congress that is more conservative. When you have Sarah Palin contesting this a House seat in, or was it a Senate seat in Alaska, and if obviously she wins like many expect her and others to do, the Senate and the House is going to become inherently more conservative. And so I think we're likely to see more legislation that way. But here's a question for you.
Can I ask a different question? Make on. A different point before you do your very valid question. Everybody saw this coming. Yeah, it's no surprise. David Runciman and Helen Thompson said on the day Biden was inaugurated on their fantastic podcast, Talking Politics, he is de facto a two-year president. He needs to get through what he needs to get through in 2 years. Otherwise, he'll struggle in the final two to get anything through, if it is his final two. But that's not out of sync with the trajectory of American politics generally. Mm. You need to get through the stuff you want to enact quickly, and you know, just speaking candidly, that's probably what you should do. When the mandate's behind you, the public are behind you, you're fresh into office, you should come to it burdened with ideas, enacting the manifesto on the platform in which you've been elected. So it's time to get it through, right?
If you have the House.
If you have the House.
And it's probably not even 2 years, because with the House being elected every 2 years, you have primaries, election campaign. I mean, the first primaries for the November elections happened back in March. Yep. Texas, I think, held its Republican and Democratic primaries on the 1st of March. So you're in campaigning season from February. So that's only 15 months. Oh no, not even that. It's 13 months after Biden came into office, and you're into election season. So I think you're absolutely right that time is of the essence because of the House elections.
You're right, their campaigning is a consistent and leitmotif of American politics, and probably all politics generally. So I don't want anyone at home thinking that we're sort of naive, we didn't see this coming, and it's sort of bad out of hell. Everyone knew it was coming. Biden too, whatever you think of him, he's nobody's fool. I'm sure he was advised that this would happen, and ultimately it just chimes with history.
You're saying they knew it would happen. It has not yet
happened. It hasn't yet happened,
but
it's very, 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 very likely. Your question.
Is he going to lose the Senate too? And if he does, what does it matter?
That's two separate questions, you rutter.
Is he going to lose the Senate? I'm not sure. I think it's a much closer call there. There's always the jigsaw puzzle of the Senate and which Senate seats are up for grabs.
Yeah.
And with only 34 going, there's always less movement, and then the number of battleground states, I guess, are fewer. But with the razor-thin majority that they've got, it only takes two Senate seats to swing the other way, and all of a sudden they have. So I don't know. I wish I had that crystal ball. It's easy. I guess partly the numbers are bigger in the House and they're all up for election every 2 years, so it's easier to discern a pattern, whereas the vagaries of the Senate elections make it much harder to outline and pick up such patterns. Were that to happen, I think it just reinforces all of the things that we've said. It makes the laws that are going to appear on the president's table, that the compromises are less likely to have been thrashed out between the House and the Senate, and are much more likely to therefore need to be thrashed out between the Congress and the president if anything is going to get into law. So,
well, let me tell you, if he holds on to the Senate, or if any president holds on to the Senate, then of course these are some of the things that the president can do. So obviously he can, he has judicial nominees all the way from the toppest of the toppermost court, the Supreme Court, all the way back down. So he has, let's say we have a resignation in the Supreme Court, or we have a death in the Supreme Court, then he can push through that pick. Now, obviously, we know that in under the previous president, there were two nominees. He got to pick two. Was it two or three?
Three
nominees.
Yeah.
Which
Gorsuch, Kavanaugh and Coney Barrett.
Which means that you have potentially extraordinary support in the Supreme Court. You can approve judges for district courts, circuit courts, and the High Court with a simple Senate majority. Now, let's not forget that the majorities that you need for legislation vary depending on the type of legislation it is. So it might be a simple, it might be a two-thirds majority, that kind of stuff. He can set his own agenda on the floor of the Senate in terms of laws. He can reject bills if the House, that's led by the GOP...
Republicans.
He can reject those bills, or at least the Senate can. They can ensure that hearings and committee times are not used. Now, this is where we get to Biden, on investigations into Biden, which potentially that's what's going to happen. But anyway, if they lose the Senate as well, there's big problems. If you're a Democrat and if you're President Joe Biden.
But not if you're a supporter of the Founding Fathers' vision for democracy, because it's just democracy doing what democracy does and chiming consistently and coherently with probably the tripartite nature of government that they envisaged. So depends which standpoint you take. For Biden, it looks bleak if he loses it, but it looks obviously positive if he can retain it. It'd be interesting.
Are we going to end up, as quite often we do in politics, with an inactive legislature? If you remember the last 10 years, we've had Congress actually being shut down. If the margins are so wafer thin, there is that potential for a gridlocked, inactive, shut-down Congress.
Which is bad for democracy, right?
Yeah.
That's bad for democracy.
Founding Fathers certainly didn't want that.
Absolutely not. And presidential orders or executive orders, that remains a recourse for the president. But it comes back to, because we can't see the future, as much as, to quote Thucydides via the conduit Simon Sharma.
He loves Thucydides.
Historians can't lobotomize citizenship and are as much warners as chroniclers of the past. It will be bad for democracy. I think it would be bad for America, whatever that means. And ultimately, I don't think it would be good for the world. It certainly wouldn't be good for the Founding Fathers, because that's not how... I can't speak for them, far greater minds than I. But I don't think it will be good.
So what have we established? We've established that historically the president loses the House, or loses influence, his party, in Congress in the midterm elections.
That's a trend borne out.
Yep, that's globally. Historically. And because he's likely to lose the House, the Democratic Party are going to lose influence, legislative influence, but the government, chances of the government coming to a standstill are obviously very low, because legislation will still get passed from the other party. But the potential is that if he loses the Senate, or if the Democrats lose the Senate, then there will be a Republican dominated agenda for the next 2 years.
Yep, that sounds about right. There is hope for the future. Professor John Leschi spoke to us on the podcast about the unknown, because it's not focused on much, but sort of unprecedented bipartisan agreement on between the parties on America's common lands, which are vast. It's about 33% of all land in America is common land.
Mm.
And the parties really do, probably going to sound naive, but really do see eye to eye on that. So there's definitely scope, capacity and potential for bipartisan agreement coming out of the current presentist context of partisanship. So it's not all bleak, doom and gloom. And from a political theory standpoint, this is democracy doing democracy by design.
Well, there we go. That
there
sounds
we are.
A good place to leave it.
Okay. I think we've solved all of those problems and answered all of those questions. Right, so midterm elections, November 2022. Watch out, see what happens. Gentlemen, anything to say?
Yeah, I'll be keeping a close eye. Sorry, Patrick has something to say then.
Yeah, AGP Taylor was wrong about one thing when he said nothing's inevitable until it happens. He was wrong. The midterms, I think Biden, unless something happens, it's really, really, really significant. He will lose those.
You rode back on your inevitability statement very quickly.
I did. I asked Rakesh Patek about cricket. He made some on his blog, the Red Bull Radical, some predictions about what's going to happen in Red Bull cricket. A few of them are right, but a few of them were awfully wrong, and I ribbed him for it. So there you go, Rakesh, if you're listening. I've just put my neck on the blog. I could be wrong, but there you go.
Okay.
Well, there we go. Let's wrap it up. Thank you very much for listening to this episode. Much more coming your way in the coming weeks as summer comes onto the horizon.
Versus History on Tour.
I'm excited for it. Ready to get the T-shirts out.
Did someone say merchandise available for purchase?
Maybe.
Did they?
Maybe. News to follow.
So we'll leave it there. Thank you very much for listening. And we'll see you again soon. That's not the right term.
Hear you?
We'll speak
no, you'll
to
hear
you again
us
soon.
Again soon. Okay. Well, goodbye from me.
Yep. See you later.
Thank you for listening to this edition of the Versus History podcast. Visit us at www.versushistory.com and follow us at Versus History on Twitter and Instagram. You can download all episodes from iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, or from wherever you get your podcasts.